We are back, baby. Welcome everybody to Laying the Points with Farley Betts. I am Farley Betts, and it is so awesome to be back with all of you on this recurring sports betting podcast. I got an infant over here. She's 2.5 weeks old. She's the cutest thing in the world. She also needs to be fed every 2 to 4 hours, and it is nonstop, but that's okay. We find time to get on here and talk to all of you with some great guests coming up down these next few weeks. Really excited about my guest today, and it's such a pleasure to be back with all of you, talking sports betting, talking NFL, talking NBA. Again, my name is Chris R. Farley, a.k.a. Farley Betts, on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. Not doing too much on TikTok recently. Is TikTok going to go away? I don't know. We'll see. Fifth place Circa winner in the 2021 NFL Circa contest. 57% career NBA winning percentage. Analyst on the BetUS NBA and NFL shows. You can still catch me on the NBA shows Monday through Wednesday. Owner of FarleyBets.com. Check out our free picks over there. Inquire about my premium picks anytime by sending me a DM. And of course, the host of what you're listening to, Laying the Points with Farley Betts, the sports betting podcast for the people, where we break down our philosophies and approaches to NFL and NBA handicapping mostly, even though we handicap a lot more sports than that. But those are obviously probably the two most popular at this point. Baseball's around the corner. Opening day in baseball today. I got a few plays on that. Hit me up anytime at Farley Betts on Instagram or Twitter if you have any questions. And thank you so much for listening. We have a fantastic guest for the comeback episode of Laying the Points. At Sharp Clark NFL joins us today to talk about his NFL origination, how he does business over there at 444.com, the way he analyzes and his methods to approaching NFL sports betting. And I love the way he talks. I love the way he reasons out his perspectives, because he comes at it with an open mind, right? Someone who's always learning, someone who's not preaching down to you, but trying to gain better edges all the time. I love it. It's a great conversation. Let's get to it. Again, thank you for listening. Subscribe today and give us, what, 5 stars, thumbs up, whatever you do on your end. Laying the Points with Farley Betts. We're back, baby. And here comes Sharp Clark. All right. The People's Betting Podcast is back. You're back at Laying the Points, and I am welcoming a guest that I really wanted to have in this podcast for a very long time, especially as I've been digesting all of his NFL content throughout last season. Ladies and gentlemen, at Sharp Clark NFL joins Laying the Points today. How's it going, man?
Good, thanks. Thanks for having me on. I never thought I'd get to meet Chris Farley, so that's exciting.
Yeah, that's an easy, a lot of people don't know him anymore, man. It's kind of sad. Yeah. You know, like the previous generations, like they don't think of Chris Farley when they think of SNL. And I'm sorry, Sharp Clark, I can't promise I'm going to be anywhere near as funny as that dude. But
no worries.
Here we are. It's a good name nonetheless, right? So, dude, you're in the off season. You're an analyst at 444.com. So check that out, everybody. Great content over there. I really didn't even know about this site until I knew about you, Sharp Clark. And I'm seeing that you guys have a ton of content. It's mostly NFL, right?
Yeah, so that there we do a lot of sports. I don't do any other sports, but NFL was kind of the flagship of the website, and it's expanded out. I know they do a lot of golf stuff and then some other sports as well.
Yeah, so I don't know if you've listened to Laying the Points before, but what I like to do on this podcast, you know, more than just giving out picks, right, the standard stuff that a lot of betting podcasts do, we like to get a little tangential on here. We like to get philosophical, talk about our betting strategies. And I've just really come to admire the way that you approach the NFL, man, because it does seem like you always come from that perspective of learning, right? Like this is, at this point, I mean, probably at any point in history, betting, sports betting, it's theory, right? And we're all trying to gain edges. We're all trying to develop ways to win more, of course. But I love how you approach it because, and I'm sure you see it from my tweets, nothing annoys me more than when there's like closed-mindedness in this industry, right? When this is the way to do something and that's it. You're not that type. You're always learning. I love that about you. Tell me something. How did you get started just in sports and sports betting as an analyst to begin with?
Yeah, so I've always been a football fan. I started betting when I was in college about 15 years ago. I came up with this genius idea that I realized that passing well correlated to winning and running well did not correlate to winning. So I came up with this master spreadsheet that compared, you know, passing versus rushing and defense and all that kind of stuff, and like created this betting system, which performed at about 51% over the course of the season. And I realized that it takes a lot more work than that to actually create an edge. So I just kind of like bet for fun over the last, you know, whatever, 10, 15 years. And then it was in 2019 that I got really serious and transitioned from like a fantasy football player who casually bets into a primary NFL bettor, developed a, you know, a, what I consider to be a unique system. And I've been working on it ever since.
Yeah. Now let me ask you this too, because we mentioned this before the pod when we were talking. You know, there's less and less like sharp sports betting dudes who are, you know, or gals who are like walking up and down the streets of Las Vegas, and that's all they do for a living, right? I think most people, even if they're in the sports betting community as an analyst now, they're probably more so in our boats, right? Where they're not necessarily a pro handicapper. It's not the only thing we do. It's not our primary way to earn income, but it is a major part of our careers, right? It's part of our earning income. How do you balance that, right? Throughout the season, I mean, I know for me, Sharp Clark, I took on way too much this fall. Just like I was on a lot of shows, doing a lot of different things, and I loved every bit of it. But man, like taking a breath some days during the week, especially, was really tough. So it could be tough, right? When you're balancing another job, maybe another job on top of that. What is your mentality when it comes to that, about still maintaining, you know, kind of a more secure income while you're doing this? Because I know some of the gambling industry look down upon that, which is really annoying to me, actually.
Yeah, a couple things. I think one, I'm lucky enough to where my full-time job allowed me to work 80% of the time. So I'm an 80% flex time worker for my day job. And then the second part of that is I don't have kids and I have a career-focused wife. So I have a lot of time on my hands when you take those kinds of things out of the equation. And then the third piece is I only do NFL. I don't do any sports in any capacity. I am 100% NFL better, and that's how much time I have to give. So I think those three things allow me to really focus and create a balance of between this side job that I really love and is very passionate about, and then my day job, which you know, pays me well, and I, you know, it's a great thing to have in my life as well.
Yeah, we're in the exact same position, right? I mean, I got a more secure 9-to-5. A lot of flexibility in that job. Now I do have a brand new infant in our lives who's definitely taking up time. And I've, you know, there's just a lot of things that's been happening the past 6 months to a year that has made my life busier, but I think it's really smart the way you approach it. Hard for me to just bet on one sport, but I know, you know, one of the reasons why I slowed down, or I was, you know, my record wasn't as efficient early in this NBA season, was because I was going as hard with the NBA as I was in the NFL. That's really hard to do. I mean, if you're really trying to gain an edge, that's a really tough thing to do. Two sports, and then, you know, sometimes I throw in some college basketball in there. You know, hard to stay away from opening day and baseball today. But I learned my lesson, man. Last year, over 300 plays in baseball, and I hit right around 51%. Didn't go that well. So I'll be avoiding that this time. But I think that's really good advice, right? Only take on what you can handle. And maybe the most important thing you said, man, time is your biggest ally with all this stuff, right? Because especially, I mean, we see it today on Twitter and everything, some of the content that's put out there, you can tell it might not be as nuanced, as rigorous, as researched as some others. And that's probably because of lack of time. So if you can put all your efforts into the NFL, that's the best way to do it. And let me ask you a little bit about your method approach, which I know this is going to be a loaded question. Go on as long as you want. You certainly don't have to give away all your trade secrets, but you do approach NFL handicapping in a different way. I can say that with confidence. A lot of things in this industry right now, a very young industry, there's a lot of regurgitated stuff, right? Like you'll read an article and it'll be like, this team is ranked here, this team is ranked here, this is the data, this is my bet. And it's not really teaching you anything, right? It's not really, there's no context to it. But you always give context. You mix in the qualitative with it too. So tell us a little bit about your approach and how you got to this point.
So I think, you know, there's a lot of things that I do differently, and sometimes it's hard to talk about because it's coming from such a different place, but I'll try to focus on what differentiates my approach. And that is, essentially there are all these advanced models. There's a lot of really smart people putting together very, very smart analytical tools to analyze the NFL and predict the NFL. But most of them are built on statistics of some kind, right? You got EPA per play, you got, you know, success rate, you got win percentage added, you win probability added, you got all these different things. And then like situationally, like, you know, here's where it matters most, or like here's, so it's like a lot of filtering out like the impact of different statistical metrics into a model. And the problem is every statistic is flawed in the same way. And that is, statistics are results-based measurements, right? They measure the result of the play as a 100% outcome of that play, because that's the only thing that happened. But I view an NFL game as a series of probabilistic events, kind of like quantum theory. Like, you know, the particle could be in one of two places, and when we observe it, it exists in one place, and that would be the statistical measurement. But the truth is, there was a probability that it didn't end up that way. And so my approach is watching every snap of every game and trying to evaluate holistically team performance on a sort of a probabilistic level to create a metric of performance that outperforms any other statistical metric. That's my goal. That's the foundation of everything that I do. And that creates a mathematical number that I assign to every team for every game. And then that gives me a data point that I can then go qualitatively and run my programs using a metric that no one else is using, frankly. And yes, it involves a subjective element, quite a substantial subjective element. But I think that creates an edge, because having a different approach to what the market is doing creates an edge, right? So like if you have an average of 1% edge on every NFL game, but you think exactly like the market does, you're going to have a 1% edge on every game, which means no game is bettable because of VIG. But if you have a different approach and that 1% average is skewed over, say, 7 bets, you've got -2, -1, 0, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4. And now you've got 2 bets, the 3% and the 4% bet, that are going to be plus EV bets. And then you pass on the rest of them. So I try to create that difference by using a somewhat subjective measurement that I think is superior to the statistics.
Yeah, Charles Clark saying quantum theory in there, folks. Don't shut off this podcast because he said that. I love it. No, but you're right, man. I love what you said about the assumptions with data, right? Because at the end of the day, we can build the most like unbelievable model with every kind of, you know, ancillary metric in there, along with the bigger metrics. And it's still an assumption based on past performance, right? It doesn't speak fully to everything that's happening on the field relationally, well, how one play affects the next play, how one play affected the coach's decision, or maybe what the quarterback did on the next play. There's just so many human elements to an NFL game or any pro sport that, you know, obviously, if we had a formula to correctly predict human behavior, that would change the world a long time ago. It's a nuanced display of human behavior on a mass scale between two groups, right? And there's so many different things that are going on at the same time that I love that you brought the word assumption in with data, because I think people are really afraid to say that. And I think, you know, a lot of my methods go back to psychology, you know, that, you know, human tendencies perspective, because I think we kind of forget about that, right? I think we like data because it makes us feel more comfortable, right? It makes us feel more secure in our bets, right? Like, this is happening 61% of the time. Surely that gives me an edge that is more probable next time. But you're only looking at that one data point, or even a group of data points, but it's not holistic. And the fact that you take it from a snap-by-snap basis, I mean, I don't know what goes into your film study, Sharp Clark, but tell us a little bit about that. I mean, are you, during the season, how much film are you watching? When are you watching it?
Yeah, well, I watch it throughout the week. I watch it on NFL Game Pass, so you can watch the condensed film. So I'm not watching the All-22. I'm not evaluating individual players on a per-play basis like PFF does. I'm evaluating holistic team performance. So it's kind of like, you know, taking all the pieces together and asking the question of, like, how effective is this offense? How effective is this defense? What I'm looking at the types of things that tend to be replicable versus the sort of fluky events that maybe lead to good outcomes in the short term, but maybe not indicative of future performance. Mm-hmm. And that's just kind of, you know, I've been doing it for 3 full seasons now. I started in 2019 and then started the full season of 2022. And every year I've improved my process as I go back and look at some things that maybe, you know, like what are my numbers pointing to or not pointing to that I can incorporate better? How can I more effectively measure performance? And I think it's just an iterative process that anyone who thinks that they can, you know, figure out their NFL process in a year is, you know, it's a joke to me. It's going to take a long time and a lot of work and, you know, self-evaluation. And that's kind of the process I'm in.
This is one of those ancillary questions that I thought might come into this, but did you see, I mean, there's a lot of parity in that. I would say more parity than what we've seen, in the sense that teams that you expected to perform at a higher level because of elite quarterbacks, right? The Aaron Rodgers of the world, Russell Wilson, Tom Brady, not so much, right? And some of those lower tier teams, the Seattle Seahawks, the Giants, you know, starting to ascend a little bit, the Jaguars. Did you get any observations or thoughts on just like, from my perspective, it looked like more parity. What did you think? Did you see that there's just less of a separation between the truly elite teams, more competition?
I do think to a certain extent. So one of the things that I noticed when I started going back into my season data was my preseason ratings for each team, they were too wide based on what mm-hmm. they ended up as, right? So I had the Texans offense, I had at too lower of a number than any team ended up at. Steelers offense too. And so these kinds of things where I came into the season with an expectation of a large gap that shrunk over the course of the season. So I do think there is some of that happening. A lot of it is, you know, the salary cap playing out, yeah. Injuries, you know, the way teams are built, that kind of stuff. But I just try to understand each team individually rather than trying to overlay a macro view of the NFL over the teams. I just have, you know, here's my archetype for this team. Here are my ratings. And then I compare performance in that game compared to what I expected and sort of measure, you know, were they better or worse than expected? Were they significantly better or worse? Why, et cetera. So I do think there was a little bit of that, but it doesn't directly impact my team ratings.
Yeah, some of our similarities are a little weird, man, because you mentioned the word archetype. I love that, right? Instead of getting too nuanced in like the micro, you're looking at it as a group. Did you study sociology in your past, psychology, anything like that?
Not directly. I like to read about stuff just for fun, but not in school.
Yeah, I mean, a beautiful mind type stuff here, man. You know, group dynamics is what we're talking about. But yeah, I mean, I love that you said archetypes, right? Because I do think that's a great starting point for anyone, even betting the NBA too. You know, teams, not just players on those teams, right? Obviously, you got guys like Patrick Mahomes and Josh Allen out there, guys that greatly affect their team more than other players. But the team itself functions in certain ways, right? You can pick up on tendencies, like, for example, the Kansas City Chiefs defense in the playoffs. Is it elite? No, but they perform better, right? And that almost always happens, right? And we see it in certain ways. So I just love that you use that word archetype. Haven't heard that from other sports bettors before. Let's talk a little bit about the industry, man. Because in my mind, you have several groups, right? You got the old heads who, a lot of them, I mean, I've connected with a lot of them, love many of them. But then there's many of them also who are, you know, they're very preachy, right? Like, this is the way to do things. These guys in these other accounts on gambling Twitter are dummies. You know, and you know, I think it's sort of them defending their positions, right? Because it's getting very saturated, right? So they're worried about kind of, you know, going into absurdity a little bit, obscenity, whatever. And then you got the group, right? The oversaturation. You got the young bettors who are just producing content constantly, right? Not necessarily high quality content. And then you have the rest of us in the middle who are just like trying to get in there, do it the right way, maybe develop models, develop our own original thoughts and strategies. Do you have any indication, you know, working from 444.com or whatever, that you can talk about where is this industry going to go? You know, are we going to see more of, you know, syndicates, you know, things like that, right? Groups betting all together, more of like a stock market approach. Is it going to relatively stay the same? Or is this just going to be a mass content, you know, monster for years and years to come until it kind of figures itself out?
Yeah, I don't think the content is going anywhere. I think it's going to be saturated for a while. But there's an interesting split here between two distinct groups of people who are betting. And I think that's an important point to recognize at the outset.
Yeah.
There are people who are professional bettors who make their living betting on sports. You know, you got guys like Spanky. And And they make a living doing it. And it's a completely different way of approaching sports betting than the other group, which is recreational bettors, right? People that have a job and they want to have some fun. They want to put money behind their opinions. They want to have rooting interests in these games. And there are far, far, far more recreational bettors than there are professional bettors. And yes, professional bettors don't need the content, right? That if they have a system that works, if they've already established, no one needs to create content for them, right? You know, you might have an occasional podcast that's like super insightful, super deep and super interesting. Great, great, great. But for the most part, the content is for the recreational bettor. And I think there's this conflict that no one really addresses directly. And that is like, the professional bettors are criticizing the content creators because mm-hmm. they're not sort of following the rules of their professional betting strategies or doing the things that are, you know, successful in their experience. But I don't think it has to be. Like, betting should be fun. And for most of the people yeah. consuming the content, they want to have fun. And I think sometimes as serious bettors, I think we forget that. And we make it all about plus EV, you know, never say anything unless it, you know, adds concrete value yep. that is going to make you a better. And I think it's a little bit more nuanced than that. However, I think that there's a difference between helpful content and bad content, even within the recreational betting space. And I think that our job as sort of, you know, we're not like huge figures or whatever, but as public faces and voices of the sports betting community, I think it's our job to funnel good content and support yep. good content that is just going to be helpful and not hinder people from betting. So I think there's a little bit of a responsibility as being some of the early people in this recreational better content space that exists right now, of just developing good, helpful content and not misleading bettors.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, if we take a step back, right, 20 years ago, I mean, hell, 10 years ago, you didn't see this kind of information sharing, right? Like, I mean, never in history could people just come together. And I mean, is like Wikipedia becoming a more formidable source? I don't know, because half the stuff you see on social media and stuff, right, people are literally following it to the end. Like, even though there's really nothing that qualifies it as something that they should follow, right? So we're kind of the, you know, purveyors of this industry. And says, you know, we need to kind of secure the proper tactics, or maybe just the questions that matter. At the same time, I don't know about you, but I feel like, as you know, someone who's really only been in this industry for 3 years now, you know, on the one hand, I think, who am I to even decide what that is? But then, you know, secondly, like you said, any industry, any business, you need to allow room to fail, right? You need to allow room for people to experiment with ideas and theories. And that's why I talk so much about theories, because this is not a science, you know, because of the human elements, because of the group behavior components. Like, we can't put scarlet letters on people. And I think, like, that's what's kind of happening now a little bit, right? And I don't know what the intention of that is. Like, at the end of the day, I think maybe it's to kind of protect their own theories and philosophies, right? So that people keep on turning to them. I mean, I get that. But the scarlet letter stuff, man, I mean, I'm not like famous by in any regard, but sometimes even to someone who has some followers, who's on some shows, you feel the weight and the pressure, and it can really piss you off, man, because like I shouldn't be somebody who's in a position to be like ridiculed or, you know, criticized or like, you know, receiving any kind of vitriol because I have a thought about sports betting. But you kind of have to be careful. And I think because Twitter is like the main place where people go to talk about it, that's where it happens. And I find myself like, I gotta take a day off from Twitter here, a day off from Twitter there. And it's just like healthy for the mind.
Yeah, I mean, I think you have to recognize the inevitability that anybody who has a following in a yep. place like Twitter for sports betting is going to have critics, and some of those critics are going to be harsh. That's true of everybody you can possibly think of. The people that you think are the most above board, solid bettors, they're getting criticized constantly. And so I think recognizing that and then taking a step back and saying, okay, so that's just part of the game. Like, I'm just going to ignore those people. And like, to the extent that other people might criticize something I say or do, like, I'm working on just letting it go, because like, I know that I'm on a journey, and I know that I'm very proud of where I'm going. I'm proud of the way that I do it. I know that I'm not ashamed of anything that I do or say. I'm not scamming. I'm not lying. I'm transparent, all those kinds of things. And I think the best thing we can do is just model good behavior. and ignore the critics. Unless they're criticizing something valid, in which case evaluate it and be like, wow, okay, is what they're saying legitimate? Is that a legitimate criticism? And if it's not, who cares? If it is, then we can reform ourselves and change and grow. And I think that process of publicly reforming and growing and learning from our mistakes is actually a really, really good thing. Like, people are afraid of admitting mistakes or admitting weakness in our society and our culture. And I think that's a major flaw. Like, I make mistakes. I am a highly flawed person. I'm a highly flawed better, but I'm getting better because I recognize that. And I try to identify what those flaws are and work on it. So, you know, I'm grateful for the critics that have helped me improve. I'm not grateful for the critics that are just, you know, shit talking all the time. And those eventually, that voice eventually just drowns out of my head and it eventually doesn't matter. And that's something that's hard to do at first, but honestly, the more it happens, the easier it is to do. And I think that's kind of our, we can focus on the negatives or we can just focus on the things that are working in our lives and focus on the things that are going well and what we can improve. And I think the second one is a path to success. And the first one is a path to being stagnant. So that's kind of where I'm at right now in terms of that aspect of the space.
Yeah, all great advice, man. I think about players too, right? It's like we expect so much of like 22-year-old, 24-year-old players who are in the limelight, under criticism all the time. And, you know, some of these guys, you know, like John Morant, you know, what happened with him recently. Do I think what he did waving a gun in a club was smart? Absolutely, duh. Like, no, it wasn't. It was a dumbass move. But at the same time, like, he's a kid. You know, like, what was I doing at that age, right? And I'm 37 years old, so my brain is fully matured, but I still have an issue with it sometimes, right? It's definitely something that I'm working on too, because, you know, maybe it's the military in me or something, but these little keyboard, you know, warriors, I want to throw them over freaking balcony sometimes when I say, like, you know, when they talk shit. But it just is what it is, and you got to get used to it. And I've been thinking about Tom Brady, actually, man, which kind of sounds silly, but that dude was pure fire when he was on the field, but when he was in front of the mic, in front of the camera, right? Positive, never said anything bad about anybody, never ousted coaches that he surely could have. And I just think he's a great example for just a lot of ways to handle that kind of pressure. And, you know, and I'm not surely not comparing myself to the pressure that he's felt in his life, but it's a different world we live in where you can make something of yourself on social media, but then some of the consequences you have to face are very interesting. Great advice, man.
I don't think it's a coincidence, right? I mean, Tom Brady's success,
that's right,
is not because of some incredible physical skill set that he had. Like, he was a seventh-round draft pick. His success is mostly mental. And I think that comes out in the way that he handles the criticism. And he obviously is someone that took it to heart. Like, you could see the competitive spirit, but not someone that let it change who he was or let it knock him off the path that he was on.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's obviously the Bucks had a lot of problems last year, but it wasn't quite the same Tom Brady throughout last season from what I mean, he still had a fantastic season. But there were moments, right, where you can tell just the execution wasn't quite there. And my God, who can blame the guy? Finally, he's going through a lot of shit in his life. Maybe his mind was finally 1% off of football for those games, right? And it's like, even with that, he was still a top 10 quarterback. You know, his team ultimately got to the playoffs, but, you know, I'll miss his mentality, man, because I think a lot of these kids these days, especially quarterbacks, can learn from him. But you got some young guns like Joe Burrow and obviously Patrick Mahomes and Jalen Hurts now, which, by the way, I appreciate you too, because before the Super Bowl, I was kind of fighting the fight against the fact that we just don't know if the Eagles can pull this off yet, right? Like, I feel like I was like arguing with everybody about it, and everybody was so convinced that the Eagles were going to just waltz in there and win a Super Bowl when they had such a poor schedule. You know, Jalen Hurts really didn't prove that he can do that in a big game yet. And, you know, now I kind of changed my mind a little bit. He was fantastic in the Super Bowl.
But, yeah, that's the wild thing, right? His best game of the year was the Super Bowl, and they still didn't win.
Right. They still didn't win. You know, that's Patrick Mahomes for you. You know, and obviously that penalty at the end didn't help. But, you know, I mean, Hurts, like, it's amazing how we like to crown athletes before they do really do anything, you know, and you know, fights like that, man, you know, get on my nerves. But let me ask you this. We're nearing 30 minutes, so we like to wrap it up around that mark. We got a few more questions for you, and just a great conversation, man. I really enjoy it. What's a weakness of Sharpe Clark betting the NFL right now? What do you think is the hardest part of gaining an edge when it comes to evaluating NFL and betting?
Well, I think the hardest part is that it is arguably the most competitive market, at least in NFL, American sports.
Right.
So we're talking about the smartest, most dedicated, most focused bettors. It's a sport where there are, you know, 6 days a week where there's either zero or one game. So there's lots of time to digest what we've seen the week before. This is a very, very competitive, especially betting NFL sides, is a very competitive market. The parallel, or the sort of, you know, I guess result of that is that it's also the most liquid market, right? So, and those kind of feed each other, you know, where you can get the most money down, you're going to have the most, you know, competitive bettors. That's also what draws me to the sport, is I want to take on the most competitive betting market and I want to beat it. That's my goal. But of course, like recognizing that that's the reality, that the level of the models going in, the you know, the analysis and the, you know, the work that the syndicates are doing to bet these games with massive bets are substantial and significant, and you have to respect that. Yes. So I think that's the hardest thing, right? It's all out there. There's time to process, and you've got some of the smartest people in the world processing it. And that's what you're going up against anytime you place a bet into the market, at least, you know, Tuesday, Wednesday on in the week.
Yeah, I mean, that's why I'll probably tout my fifth place circa win for at least a few more years, because there's a chance that I never even get close to that again, right? Like these are some of the sharpest minds in sports betting, obviously, that join contests like that. Have you been a part of contests yet?
Yeah. So 2020 was when I first implemented the system, and I wish I had done a circa contest. At the time, I had no idea whether or not I'd be successful, so I joined a free contest on DraftKings. But it was the same format, five games against the spread every week. There were 97,000 people that entered because it was free. First place was $10,000. And I actually tied for first at 70% on the season. Yes. So 7,500 was what I took, because first was 10,000, second was 5,000. And so that was great. And then, so then the 2 years ensuing, I've done circa and not done as well, not placed either year. The timing was bad, but I know that it's possible. I know that I can get there. It's a very competitive, and ultimately, like, you have to get lucky in several results that could have gone either way, just because of the way that the game works. You know, like, at least 30% of the games or so are decided by something that you couldn't have predicted before the game kicked off. So you have to win a good portion of those in addition to being sharp on the others.
100%, man. I mean, I always say that about the win. It's like, I remember in week, was this a week? There was a week 18 in 2021. Yeah. I remember the Bills in the last game, they were against the Jets, and they just took the ball down the field with like 2 minutes left and scored another touchdown. Didn't have to score it. We covered because of that, but that was probably a difference of 30 grand.
Right.
Because of that. Right. And there was really, truly no reason why the Bills. Now, of course, there were other games, right? Like, we bet on the Browns that day. A game that the Browns were, for many reasons at the time, should have won, primed to win, playing against backups, and they didn't cover, right? So it goes back and forth.
Yeah.
But a tremendous, I mean, I would say probably 20 to 25% of your circuit win is going to be some luck involved, because that's the NFL. That's the volatility of the NFL on a week-to-week basis. Let me ask you this. What was your most surprising result last season? Like, is there any game that you were like, holy shit, I really thought I was going to win that bet? What happened?
I mean, there's so many. it depends. Okay, so is this sort of a crazy end game result, or wow, I was way wrong in that game?
Either one.
Okay, so I'll go with way wrong. You know, opportunity for humility here. I was actually arguing with Las Vegas Chris about this before the game.
I argue with Las Vegas Chris all the time, so that's good. Yeah. He's a good mind.
Cowboys, Rams were favored by like 4 or 5. I don't know what the exact spread was, but I bet on the Rams, you know, and Chris was like, what are you doing? Like, the Cowboys are obviously the right side here. And I was still holding on to that belief that Matthew Stafford was able to kind of overcome that offensive line issue that he had. But in addition, I was underestimating the Cowboys again. Like, I underestimated them with Cooper Rush several times. And this was kind of the culmination of it. And he was just saying, you know, the Cowboys defensive line is going to destroy them, and it's just not going to be pretty. And the Rams were favored by over a field goal. It's like a massive edge for the Cowboys. And sure enough, it was. The Cowboys were the right side, 100%. I was way wrong, and it was very humbling.
Sure, yeah. And, you know, Las Vegas Chris is one of those guys, too, who will tell it to you straight, which I appreciate that about him. Yeah. Mine would probably be the Chiefs and Colts, which I think was week three, which I admit wasn't a great spot to take the Chiefs, but that's the reason why I was at a Circus Survivor. And last year would have been a great year to hang in Circus Survivor because there was truly only a few people left at the very end, which like doesn't happen. So, I mean, who's to say if I would have still made it to the end, but like, come on, Chiefs, you lost to the Bills, Bengals and Colts. Like that, those were the Chiefs' losses last year. So, but there was this like confluence of events, obviously, that happened in the first half of that game. Remember, there's like a punt block.
Yeah, no, it was wild. I bet on the Colts that game against the spread.
I felt lucky to have covered.
I felt lucky to have covered my spread bet in a game that they won outright, and they were like 7 point dogs or 6 point dogs.
Yeah, it was unbelievable. Well, I know you wanted to touch on NFL season win totals, but so let's do that quickly. It is very early, right? It's still March. We haven't even had the NFL draft yet. How does one approach betting NFL totals this early without knowing the full roster evaluation at this point?
Yeah, I mean, I think the general advice that I kind of take into the offseason is you want to capitalize on uncertainty. You want to be able to envision the way that things break unexpectedly throughout the season, right? So let's say you have a model that predicts the outcomes of games, and it, you know, you simulate the model throughout the season based on the schedule when it comes out, and you get like 8.7 wins on average for this team or whatever. What you want to do is build something into that model that accounts for potential changes, right? So let's say in week one, it's Chiefs against the, I don't know, Texans, right? You might have Chiefs at like 85, 90% winning that game. But in that 10% or 15% chance that the Texans win that game, how many of those results indicate that you were wrong about the Texans or the Chiefs in that game? Probably not many were wrong about the Chiefs. Probably they were wrong about the Texans.
Right.
And so you have to have a system that in those 10 to 15% of the time that the Texans win that first game, they might actually be better. So you have to kind of improve your rating on the Texans as a result of that win, right? Not all the time, but some of the time. And if you have if you build that into your model, you're going to find yourself with more realistic results because teams don't always end up how we think. Like if you'd have had the Broncos as your preseason rating throughout the season, you'd have had a way inflated win total, right? They weren't as good. They suffered injuries. That matters too. And so over the course of the season, teams look very different. The Rams, another one. So I think you can capitalize on that by one, like running those models and simulations and finding out the percentage of outcomes at certain win levels and trying to identify whether or not there's value betting all spreads, for example, betting divisional outcomes, for example. And I think that's you have to have a robust way of doing it. And I think one way to gain an edge on the market, which typically looks in terms of like, well, Pythagorean wins, expected wins, things like that, is to use these kind of volatility concepts in your model and create just more nuanced ranges of outcomes. That's kind of how I would advise people going about wanting to actually make plus EV futures bets as opposed to just, hey, I like this team, I want to bet on them, which is fine too. But if you're going to be anticipating making money, you've got to have a way to differentiate yourself from the market.
Now, yeah, and I don't want to give away any of your content on 4for4 or anything else, but do you have any inclinations, leans at this point?
Yesterday, I'll say this one because I actually put it on Twitter complaining. The DraftKings was hanging Falcons over 7.5 wins at plus 100, which I took. They limited my bet and then moved the line. So now it's, I think they're up to minus 125 now, which I don't like at that value. But I think there are some other books that maybe have better prices. Caesars might have 115, which might be worth it. The Falcons are a team that, you know, offense tends to be more stable from year to year. Granted, we have a huge unknown at quarterback, but huge unknowns when we're talking about a young quarterback typically are a thing you want to bet on more often than not. We see it all the time where quarterbacks are given time to adjust to the NFL and then they show a little bit in their rookie year and then they make a huge step in year two, year three. And I think there's at least a chance that that's Ritter. If it's not, you know, I think Taylor Heinicke is a fine quarterback too, as a backup. There's also a very, very slim chance. It looks like very slim, but Lamar Jackson may end up there. Great. That'd obviously make that a great bet. Either way, the defense has improved vastly. The offensive line is good. The skill players are good. The coaching is good. The coaching creates an offensive friendly system, and their schedule is an absolute joke. Absolute joke. Like, people are posting, you know, here's the strength of schedule for these teams, and they're basing it on Vegas win totals. But the thing is, there are so many teams on their schedule that their win totals are inflated because they also play an easy schedule. Like, we have this massive gap between the AFC and NFC, and in particular, the AFC division that the Falcons are up against is the AFC South, which is dramatically worse than the other three divisions.
South versus South. Wow, yeah.
Yeah, they don't face the Chiefs. They don't face the Bengals, the Bills, right, the Chargers, the Eagles, the Cowboys, the 49ers. They face none of those teams. By my count, 12 of their opponents are below average, and the other five are, you know, whatever, like the Saints twice. I want to say the Jaguars, the Lions, and, you know, one other team that's like, okay. So I just think that they can be an average team and clear 7.5. So that was kind of like playing into that sort of anti-fragility. Like, it's possible they, you know, Ritter sucks. Ritter could be awful, but that's what it would take for them to miss that 7.5.
Or the Raiders could be really good for 3.5 quarters and then blow it like they usually do. So yeah, but you heard it here first, ladies and gentlemen. Atlanta Falcons, watch out for them next season. Man, I got to have you back during the NFL season, Sharp Clark, to talk more NFL. I'm sure you're everywhere during the NFL season and a lot busier. But if we can talk or keep on talking during the week-to-week grind that is the NFL season, I think we could have more great conversations about it. So everyone can catch you at 444.com, right? And at Sharp Clark, that's Clark with an E, at Sharp Clark NFL on Twitter. Sharp Clark, man, thank you so much for joining us, man. This is long awaited for me because I've loved your content. And like I said, I got to have you back.
Yeah, this was fun. Thanks, Chris.
Appreciate it, buddy.